welcome, all of you. How are you doing, by the way? Yeah? Good? Cool. Super blessed to be with you. If you were here on Sunday, even if you were here on Monday, which we covered Ezekiel in the Bible trolley, you would have heard me say that we're going to do an overview of Daniel tonight. That was until yesterday afternoon. It really just kind of occurred to me that that would be getting ahead of ourselves as far as what I really think the Lord wants to do during this time over the summer. I'm learning constantly from the time that the Lord kind of said, hey, you know, do this on Monday nights and do a Bible overview. And I'm just kind of, I'm learning as we go. And we'll keep learning. We'll learn together. But basically, let me just kind of explain to you the setup and how we find ourselves here tonight and what we're going to do over the summer. Basically, beginning the first Monday night in January, we started what we call the Bible trolley. In its simplest, smallest form, it's simply a basic Bible overview. Easy enough, right? A basic Bible overview. We started with Genesis 1 through 11. Took two times to go through Genesis, and then the rest of the time, I don't think we've taken two times to go through a book since. It's just an overview, big picture type stuff. Well, as Wednesdays, you guys know we have our men's and women's studies on Wednesday nights in the fall and in the spring. And as those came to an end here in the spring and we're getting close to summer, it just seemed like a wise thing to do to move the trolley over to Wednesday nights for the summer for several different reasons. For one thing, it allows more people to be a part of it. Mondays can be tricky nights. And it kind of gives us a fresh start to something we've been doing for a while. And it also made sense because we actually find ourselves right at Daniel and then the minor prophets. See, on Monday nights, I take a significant amount more of time teaching because we have big books. Now we got smaller books. We don't have to take as much time. Something we can do real laid back on a Wednesday night. But then, considering it, I realized, for one thing, a lot of you haven't been going through the Bible trolley with us, which is totally fine. I'm so glad you're here. It's a good thing. But I didn't want to jump just right into Daniel and keep moving as if we all knew what we were doing. I think it'd be a shame if we went to however many handfuls of these Wednesday nights you're going to go to. It might be all of them, it might be half of them, it might be a few of them, I don't know. But I think it would be a shame at the end of it if we look back and we said, oh, I understand the minor prophets a little better. To me, that falls way short of what God wants to do. I mean, for one thing, what does it mean in your life, right? And for another thing, okay, now I have an understanding of the minor prophets, but what about the rest of it? And where does it fit in and why? Why do I have an understanding of the minor prophets? I still can't pronounce their names. Why do I have an understanding of it? So to step back, let me just put it this way. One of the things that I've found so invaluable in my life, in so many aspects of my life, is to be able to step back and try to get the big picture. Sometimes it's easier than others. But whether it be life as a whole or just a job or a relationship or anything, to step back and just ask the simple questions, right? What am I doing here? What's the point of it? Because you guys know that you can start with simple ideas and then as you go along, things get complicated. You forget even why you're doing anything. It happens with all sorts of things. And so I found it to be invaluable. I'm sure you guys have too, to just step back and go, what are we trying to accomplish? What is the main purpose? To me, that's what the Bible trolley is. It's zooming out. A lot of times around here at Calvary Chapel El Cajon, we zoom in on the scriptures. And that is huge, and it's great, and it's important, it's necessary. I can't stress that enough. I love zooming in on the scriptures. But sometimes you have to zoom out. Sometimes you have to zoom all the way out to even understand what you've just zoomed in on, right? Have you guys ever, I find myself doing this all the time, whether it's Google Maps or MapQuest or something, and somebody will say, maybe I've just talked to somebody on the phone, oh, I'm living in this town now. The town sounds familiar, not that familiar. I'll punch it in. All of a sudden, I have a zoomed-in version of this town. No bodies of water around it. Land and the name of the town. What's the first thing you do? You start zooming out till you recognize something, right? Zoom out. Okay, I recognize that area. Is that close to? And then you zoom out even more. It's helpful. Very beneficial. It's good for us to do it as Christians. I don't care how long you've been a Christian. I don't care if you aren't a Christian. It's good to step back and just say, well, what is the Bible really about? Something that I am acknowledging more and more just with time is that we can't just assume these things. We can't just assume what the Bible's about because we've heard about it so much. And we can't just assume that other people know either. I was thinking about the other day in the Union Tribune, there was a little headline thing about a guy that was, I think, from a Unitarian church. And it doesn't say that, of course, right up front. It just says that this reverend is saying that the Genesis account actually tells evolution. It's not just it's not just that you can work evolution into it, but it actually is talking about evolution. And that's like it, on the main page. And I'm not sure if it's Union Tribune because this was online, so I'm not sure if it made the paper front page or not. But anyways, it again just occurred to me that, you know what, we can't take anything for granted. Because somebody that doesn't know the Bible, would you blame them for looking at that and thinking, look, the Christians still have this thing messed up. And the more they look at it, the more they don't understand what they believe. I mean, that's a conclusion that people make that don't understand. We can't take it for granted. And as believers, we can't just assume, oh, I've been to church so long, I know the basics. Even if we do, it's good to go back to them. It's good to zoom out and just get the big, full understanding. So just a couple things as we go along to do this. We're going to, just so you know, we're going to go real quickly through the whole story of the Old Testament so that we understand why the minor prophets, when the minor prophets, where the minor prophets, you know, why should I care? That type of thing. So we're going to go real quickly through the Old Testament story, which is God's story, by the way. Go real quickly through that. Then we're going to talk a little bit about what and who the prophets were and what they were doing. And then I'll tell you what we're going to do for the rest of the time and kind of what order we're going to tackle these minor prophets in. Because in the end, we're still going to do the same thing. We're going to do a basic overview of these minor prophets. But first things first, right? First of all, I just want to show you a little picture there. This is a zoomed out. Do we need the... Yeah, you can hit that light that says a projector over just the one of them. Hopefully we can see a little better. A zoomed out picture. You guys recognize that? Anybody tell what it is? You see the northeast of the continent of Africa there, right? You see what's the Persian Gulf in there. You see what's mostly Saudi Arabia these days. And basically up in here is the Holy Land. So that's a zoomed out version of the geography of the Old Testament. So that when we start zooming in, we can remind ourselves where we're at on the globe. Does that make sense? Good to go? Okay, we move in a little closer. This one, now notice all the red there. You can't even see the land because I pulled this up off of it's a cool site. It has all of the Bible lands on, and they just place it right there on Google Maps, and it's the satellite image with the Bible lands right there. And you can see this area of Israel, and Jerusalem is just covered because so much of the Bible takes place there. But let me just show you something real quick. If you can follow, you guys see that laser? Okay, I'll do it in a square, but let's say we just come down here, cut across over to here, and up. See that rectangle I'm making? The entire Old Testament takes place in that section there. Every single thing you read about in the Old Testament takes place in that section. The reason why you go this far up north is because you have Assyria, and you have what would be Nineveh up in here, where Jonah preaches to. Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. Come down here to Babylon. Of course, you have the origins of human life as we know it in this area. It's believed that the Garden of Eden is somewhere around here. Obviously, I'm pointing at a pretty large place. You're not going to find it. It's not there anymore. But that it was around there somewhere. That when Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldeans. It was in this area, and he was called out into the promised land of Canaan here. When I'm just kind of roughly going over the geography here. In Egypt, of course, that's where, right at the top part of the Nile, that's where most of the Israelites were at and where they were at when they actually got delivered out of Egypt. So, and tons of stuff happens up in here, of course, in Canaan, in Israel, near Jerusalem, tons of stuff. So that rectangle, you got the entire geographic landscape of the Old Testament. Just important, good for us to be reminded of. Oh, by the way, let me just tell you a couple things. That sheet that you have there, that little booklet thing, two things about it just real quick. You don't need to grab it because I'm going to tell you to disregard it right now. two things about it. I didn't make it, and it's just going to be helpful for us. It's going to be a tool. Check it out. It gives you kind of a brief overview, but don't worry too much about that. The other thing I want to tell you is that I did put all the PowerPoint up on the CC El Cajon website under Bible Trolley. You can get the PowerPoint there if you want it. You know, we're going to go over some of this stuff kind of fast, so there's, you know, if you really want to check it out and write it down, it'll be there. Just a reminder, here's the books of the Old Testament in the order that we find them in. Follow down in column. The left column, law, history, poetry, prophecy. The Old Testament, the New Testament, the Bible is not in chronological order. But in the canon, in the Bible, this is how you'll find them. And you'll find them in sections, in themes. That is law, history, poetry, and prophecy. Well, tonight we find ourselves, we already finished up Ezekiel. Through the summer, we're going to cover these books. Going to be done with the Old Testament by then. But again, just wanted to show you in the Bible where we're going to be at. Now, we're going to kind of work together on this. I want us to talk about the story that's in the Old Testament. And so I'll be asking you, and we'll kind of just try to, essentially what we're going to be thinking is the general timeline of God's story in the Old Testament, kind of as it happens chronologically. I'll work with you. I'd love your input. I have certain things in a certain order, so if I put up a word that isn't the exact word you use, it's just because I did this ahead of time and so on. But I want to talk about it. I want to remind ourselves. I think it's really good and really important as believers to be able to do this. Is it not the case with so many Christians today that we are so consumed with our story that we even forget the Bible is God's story? We think, oh, I'm going to read this, and how does this apply to me today? And God's thinking, you know, maybe you should wonder how you fit into what I'm doing. Maybe. I mean, he is God, and he's eternal and all, right? So that would make sense. But isn't that the case with so many of us? In this world, we are self-centered, we're egocentric, we think everything revolves around us, and therefore when we go to the Bible, even though we're Christians, we still think, what does this mean to me? Okay, that's fine. But first, what's it saying? What's the whole story? I'm telling you, it will make all the difference in the world if you understand the whole story and how you fit into it before you just think about, God, I'm hurting this very moment and I need your help right now. Because our identity in Christ and our understanding of who we are to the true and the living God is what really helps us. That's the comfort. And to understand the whole story is such a huge thing. In fact, I sat around with my kids today and just kind of said, hey guys, you're going to help me study. We're going to talk about God's story. Where does it start? So that's the first question, right? Where does God's story start? What's the first thing in the Bible? Genesis. What's the first thing, person, or place? Daniel. In the beginning, God. Good. I heard somebody else say creation. I would immediately think of creation, which is absolutely true, except we got to take it one step back, right, and say, because really in that first verse, you have all kinds of things going on. You have a location, you have a time, you have a person, you have an action, all these things. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But without God, you don't have anything else in that verse, right? And not only that, but we know from the Bible, so we're kind of working outside of Genesis 1:1. We know from the Bible that God lives outside of time, that he's an eternal being, that he had no creation, that he has always existed, always will exist. He doesn't have needs of anything else outside of himself, always existed. So we'll say it starts with God. Fair enough, right? The story of God starts with God. Makes sense. Now, we already talked about it. It talks about God creating. It talks about God creating several things. It talks about God creating. What does God use to create most of the things he creates with? He speaks, exactly, his voice. He speaks it into existence, the universe, the earth, the animals. But there's one thing that he doesn't speak into existence. What's that? Man and woman. Did he make one first? Yes. Did he use different methods? Yes. But essentially, this is what's important to us. He formed us with his hands, spoke everything else into existence. I hope there's none of us that doubt whether he could have done that with us. Let there be man. Easy enough. But he formed us. We, in essence, have his fingerprint all over us. So we got God, creation, humanity. And another important thing, not only did he form us, but he formed us in his image. Imago Dei. So important. We were made in God's image. I guess we could ask the question right now, why? Why did he make man? It's a good question. For him, essentially, huh? For his pleasure. We would quote the first question and answer to the Westminster Catechism. What is the chief end of man? To glorify God and to enjoy him forever. That's truth. And we boil it down. We just say, God made us for him. And something that, I don't know if you guys regret sin or not, but God made us for him and made the earth for us. The animals said, have dominion over this. Of course, we know that didn't last very long. I just want to remind you before we get further in the story that how much God had to do with the beginning of the story. We immediately jump to man, don't we? Because we think of us. Where do we fit into it? But guys, as soon as man's in the picture, just about the first thing we hear about him is that he messes it all up. But the eternal God who created things, that's what the story's about. And if we just jump into, let's talk about Haggai, the minor prophet, we're going to be kind of lost, aren't we? So let's keep going with the story. Humanity, what happens next in the story? What's that, Daniel? The fall. We call it the fall, when Adam and Eve sinned. How did they sin? Well, God gave them a choice. God gave them the liberty to be able to obey him or to disobey. They disobeyed. What that brought into the world was all kinds of things that we call the curse or the fall, but death followed and things were just uglier from then on. We even today can look out and see beauty in God's creation, but we live in a fallen world and we can see evidence of that all around us. You have the fall. Now, we're going to have to fast forward a little bit because we only have so much time tonight. Essentially, I guess the next question will be, well, after the fall and man and woman had sinned, they pretty much shaped up, right? No more sin. They stayed right on track? No. In fact, hundreds of years down the road, God looks and says, every single person is wicked. Everybody's wicked. Judgment. We might not like it. Judgment. Came. And we know this came in the form of a flood. We know about Noah and the ark. God didn't obliterate the human race. He saved Noah and his family. So when that ark lands and the waters dry up, it's Noah and his family. And every single one of us could trace our ancestry. Not, we might not be able to trace it back by name, but we know that if we could, we'd go back to this guy, Noah. So you have the flood, and then everybody said, that's it. The curse, the flood, no more sin. We're going to do what's right. We're going to stay on the level, perfect righteousness from then on out. And that's God's story. Okay, not necessarily. So, bunch of sinners. Again, right? God had already promised he's not going to judge the world again through a worldwide flood. What does he do? He decides, because essentially, and we're men talking about eternal God, so this is difficult. But essentially, God is, from the best we can understand, he's looking at it this way. He loves mankind. He created us to walk with him, to give him pleasure. In fact, when we walk with him, we give him pleasure. You want to give God pleasure? Walk with him. But he looks around, the world is not walking with him. And time has elapsed from creation. And people are less people are worshiping him, less people are believing in him, less people know his words and what he's like. And so one of the first things, I hate to say going through his mind, but in our mind, that's what he's doing, is he wants to reveal himself and his character to the nations. He's looking down at the world and he wants to reveal himself. And not only that, but there's a problem that can't be dealt with unless these people are redeemed back to him. Okay, so those are the two main things. He wants to love mankind. I guess there's three things. He wants to love people, he wants to reveal himself to people, and he wants to save people. So he does this. He finds one man to build up a nation through. The rest of the Old Testament has everything to do with that one man and that nation built up through him. But primarily it has to do with God's heart to love people, to reveal himself to people, and to save people. So again, when we find ourselves in the Minor Prophets and we're going, this is just crazy stuff. I'm not really sure why I have to read this. And it all fits into this, and it fits so perfectly. Okay, so you have God, creation, humanity, fall, flood. You have the nation, which was, who was the guy that God built up a nation through? Abraham. So you have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. The 12 sons of Jacob are the 12 tribes of Israel. Where do they end up going? Where do they find themselves? It's like the ruling empire of the time, of the days. In Egypt. So they find themselves in Egypt, all good at first. 400 years later, not so good. They're in slavery. God needs to do what? Well, God doesn't need to do anything, but what does God do for his people? Yeah, saves them. He brings them out through the Red Sea. Of course, Moses fits in at this time. I'll try to mention names when I can of the huge guys and where they fit in this. But God uses Moses to bring them out. Now, he brings them out, and they're down at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula, at the bottom of Mount Sinai, and God decides to reveal himself. Now, again, let's think of this in just terms, big terms. If God's going to raise up a nation, what is God's nation, or any nation, going to need? I mean, they need an identity. They need, what are some things that a nation looks for? A leader, very good. Laws, great. And we'll say too, because not for every nation, but God's nation is going to need worship, right? They're going to need a method of worship. And there's one other thing that we haven't said yet that a nation needs. Land. Okay, so first things first though, he's going to give the law. The law for the people. So he gives the law. In essence, the moral law is pretty much contained. We find it nice and concentrated in the Ten Commandments, right? Gives the law. In fact, we'll just kind of shoot through here. We got the law, sacrifice, because that's going to be the form of worship that they're going to have. And not only sacrifice, but the tabernacle, which is eventually going to be the temple. These are all really important things in the Old Testament. There's going to be certain ways that God has to be worshipped, essentially because he needs to show that blood has to be shed, that these sins have to be paid for, that they're serious. And there's going to be only a certain place where God can be worshipped, the temple. Because these are all going to be pictures of Jesus. Because in the end, there's going to be only one way to God, and that is through faith in his Son. And all these things are going to picture that. And not only that, but practically, if he lets this happen any other way or any other place, it's going to get diluted and distorted, right? If he says, okay, worship just wherever you want, and it's going to get messed up. No, he wants to make sure that the way to God is very clear, and so he keeps it concentrated in that way and in that area. Now, the next thing they do, they spend 40 years wandering through the wilderness. But after the wilderness, do they ever get into the land? They do. They get into Canaan. Joshua brings them in to the promised land. They're in the promised land, but after Joshua dies, there's no real core central leadership, right? What period of time is that after Joshua dies? And who's ruling? I can't hear you. Judges, yeah. So there's a period of judges where things are all out of sorts. Everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. They're not obeying God. And God just keeps delivering them. It's a big circle. Sin, punishment, repentance, restoration. Sin, punishment, repentance, restoration. Over and over again. And God uses the judges to deliver. Well, eventually they want a king. God's goal in this whole thing is that they be a theocracy, governed by God. They're God's people. There's no, just so we make this clear, because we get this confused sometimes, especially Americans do. There has never been, nor will there ever be, a nation, a genetic bloodline nation that is God's nation. Now, I'm not going to get in an argument, but the bottom line is, it's just the truth. Now, we want the Lord to bless America, and there's a lot of good things about America, a lot of bad things, and I love the country, and I'm all for it, but we need to make sure that we don't now say, well, we're like the Jews, because we're a Christian nation. These things are for His people that He's raised up for a certain reason. We can't forget these things. So, promised land, judges, God wants to be their king. They want a king like all the other nations. They want to be like just all the other nations. They're very rebellious, they're complaining all the time. So they get a king. There's the monarchy. Except for the hiccup at the beginning with Saul, things go pretty well overall because David, a man of God, then Solomon. With Solomon, I mean, that was the peak of Israel's kingdom. After Solomon, downhill. The kingdom divides, and then from then on out, it's just not good. There's very little up in Israel because they divide 10 kingdoms in the north, 2 kingdoms in the south. We're going to talk about this as we talk about the prophets. But the 10 kingdoms in the north are called Israel. Not one good king reigns in that time. Now, down in the southern kingdom, which is 2 tribes, Judah and Benjamin, that stays with the line of David. God promised that the throne would stay with David, culminating in the Messiah. Jesus came through David's line. There were a few good kings in Judah, which is, I mean, things got ugly. The things that they basically started following all these other gods. There was much bloodshed, innocent bloodshed. The worship was, you know, was that of other nations. So it could either have to do with temple prostitutes and stuff, which there were all kinds of. Even in God's own temple, this had come in. And not only that, but there were other idols where they would actually sacrifice their babies for that idol. Things had gotten bad, and they just kept getting bad. And so sometimes in Judah, new kings would come in, bring some reform, but still, overall, it's a downward slope. So what that means is exactly what God promised it would mean in Deuteronomy. God made it very clear to Moses and then to the others that, hey, here's my law. You obey it, you'll be blessed. You disobey it, you'll be judged. It's that simple. So if we find ourselves here, hundreds of years down the road, divided kingdom, they're disobeying God's law, what does that mean is coming? Judgment. So, in this time, when there are so many people not following God, the rulers, by and large, not following God, disobeying God, doing things that in His eyes are very vile, these things that we've already just kind of hinted at. And there's impending judgment coming. God already said, they have the law. God already said, if you do this, you'll be blessed. If you don't, you'll be cursed. To be a good God, He does not have to do anything else at this point. What is coming is judgment. It's off the screen a little bit. I think most of this line might be, but we'll get the idea. Judgment is coming. it's just the way it goes. He gave the choice, just like he did from the beginning with Adam and Eve. God wants to show his grace, but by their decision, he gets to show his wrath. They're not contradictory. Now, we don't have time to get into all of this stuff. They're very difficult questions. But in the end, hopefully we understand that to love something, well, many of us have kids, right? It would be impossible for us to love our kids but not hate anything else, right? Because if something's going to harm my kids, I'm going to hate that. If I love good, then I'm going to hate evil because it takes away the good. And so in just a nutshell, that kind of explains why these things aren't contradictory and why we don't have a different God in the New Testament than we do in the Old. But impending judgment is coming, and God, out of his grace, sends prophets. So that's where we're going to find ourselves. God, out of his grace, sends prophets. Now, you might read the prophets and say, there's a lot of, man, I mean, there's a lot of judgment coming. Well, yeah. And he didn't have to warn them of it either. And the warning is, if you continue down this way, judgment's coming. There will be destruction to Jerusalem. But if you turn, there won't be. It's a warning. And that's what we find constantly. Well, he sends the prophets. It doesn't, well, we'll just say for quick purposes, it doesn't work. They continue in their evil. It works. His purposes are accomplished. He gets his word across, and we have their words right now. They're very important, but they do not turn around. They go into captivity. Israel gets dispersed, taken up to the north. Assyria is the reigning empire at the time. Judah, about 120 years later, gets taken into captivity. They last longer because they have more good kings. There's more kind of up beats. As they're going downhill, there's still some reform and so on. But they all end up in captivity, in exile. 70 years later, Judah, much of them, not all of them by any means, a lot of them just stay dispersed. But a remnant return from exile. And what they do is they rebuild the temple and the wall. And there's prophets during this time too. And then what you have is silence. You have 400 years of silence between God and humanity. And again, we're taking broad strokes here. So we'll just say, essentially, God warned them. God wanted to be with them. God wanted to walk with them for hundreds, thousands of years. They said, no, we don't want you. Essentially, God said, fine, you can have what you want. So this is God's story. This kind of helps me. This is very general, but just to kind of, because they're big numbers, and if you just say roughly 4,000 BC, and again, this is general. This is just if you look at the genealogy, roughly 4,000 BC, Adam's on the scene. Cut that in half. 2,000 BC, Abraham. Cut that in half. 1,000 BC, David and the kingdom rule. Around 600 BC, they go into exile. Around 500, return. Then from 400 BC to the turning point, there is there's silence. And then I put, guess who shows up on the scene. It's almost like God intended. I mean, it's just kind of weird that it's all a countdown. Huh. I mean, I'm not using Bible dates. I'm using dates that we use. These are real dates. It's all a countdown. It's weird. Okay. So, that's God's story. Okay? In a nutshell. I know it was quick, but that's God's story. What's that?
Good job.
Oh. Well, so now we're going to talk a little bit about the prophets. We understand in the big picture why they're there. Out of God's grace, he sent these guys. Because, remember, God used men. He used leaders. Remember, he spoke through Moses, who really was kind of one of the first prophets. I mean, there were prophets throughout the Bible. But in this section where we have the writing prophets is also a period of time where just most of the line of prophets live that we know of as prophets. But God used Moses. God used Abraham prior to that. After Moses, God used David. There were prophets. But in the end, the kings weren't righteous anymore. So it makes sense it makes sense that God, if God's going to raise somebody up, it's not going to be a king anymore. They're not righteous. Instead, it's going to be somebody that has access to the king that can warn them. That's what it is a lot of times. And it's not a pretty job. Again, if you think of main biblical offices at that time, you pretty much have the kings, the priests, and the prophets. We don't want to get those confused. The priests, if they were God's priests, good priests, they were in Jerusalem, serving in Jerusalem. I mean, they could live elsewhere when it wasn't their time to serve, but that was the only place a priest could serve. And they did the work of the Lord. They helped sacrifice. They helped keep things right in the sanctuary part with the incense and so on and all those things. That's what a priest did. A king does what a king does. We all know. We understand that position primarily. And then a prophet was simply a person that God specifically put his call upon to prophesy. It was a specific person. They had to have the call of God. You didn't go to school to be a prophet. Now, there was a school for prophets. That doesn't mean that it was a school to learn how to be a prophet. It meant that if you were a prophet, you could go there and dig into the scrolls of Scripture together. It wasn't a lineage thing. King's lineage, right? Passed down through the line of families. Father, son, you're a king. Same with priests. Not with prophets, though. God would pick somebody, sometimes somebody of nobility, sometimes somebody at the bottom of the rung, as far as socially goes. They had all different kinds of backgrounds. Now, really the first of the line of prophets, I would say, would be Samuel. He's very clearly a prophet. He's risen up right as the time of monarchy comes in. He's the one that actually anoints Saul, right? And he's that connecting point because he's the last of the judges, the first of the prophets, anoints the first king. Samuel really is kind of the first in the line of prophets. And then there are several after that. All kinds of prophets mentioned in the Bible. Some you would never recognize their name. There are all kinds of false prophets mentioned in the Bible. And the main thing to know about them is they were simply there because they were on somebody's payroll. You know, a righteous prophet is saying judgment's coming. Well, what does the prophet on the payroll say? No judgment. Take it easy. God would never destroy his people in his temple. That's your false prophet for you. Now, some of the big prophets that we know about that come a little bit later, Elijah and Elisha, huge prophets. They did amazing things, but we don't have anything that they wrote down. What we're talking about, because we get our information and the prophecies from them, are the ones that wrote stuff down. So that's what we're covering. Now, they're divided into either major or minor prophets. You've heard that we're going to cover the minor prophets. What's the difference? Do the minors get a move up to AAA and then into major prophets after a while? And then, you know, if a major prophet isn't really hitting that well with his prophecies, do they have to send him down to AAA before he's brought back up? No. Prophets are prophets. In fact, the office of a prophet, everything you said had to come true or you weren't a prophet of God. God is 100% right. Okay, so this isn't just like geopolitical strategy and forecasting. This is prophecy, had to come 100% true. So all these guys are prophets on the same level. Essentially, guys, it sounds kind of funny, but the only reason they're major or minor is because the major prophets wrote bigger books. It's that simple. Isaiah, big book. Jeremiah, big book. He wrote Lamentations, squeeze that together. We'll call that a major prophet too. And then Ezekiel. And then Daniel's kind of, you know, I've seen him on, he's never on the minor prophet list. Sometimes he's not on the major prophet list, though. I don't know. Because of what he did is so important. We mostly would call him a major prophet. And then you have the minor prophets. But again, it's just because of the length of the book. It has nothing to do with how important their message is. So it's not like, well, minor prophets, man. You know, these messages are weak. These guys were just trying things out, you know. They weren't even, you know, they didn't have huge multi-million dollar contracts. They were, you know, they were just starting out. No, nothing like that. I already mentioned this in the Bible, but I'll mention it now too. The prophetic books are not in chronological order. Some of it is we don't have dates for some of them, so we don't know exactly. But even the ones that some of the ones that we know, they're just not in chronological order in the Bible. So that's important to mention, and hopefully that'll help you understand the way I'm going to be doing it through these Wednesday nights in the summer. Basically, a prophet did two things. One of the things that we think of all the time when we think of a prophet is that they told the future, right? That they spoke of things to come. We think of that as prophecies. That's one of the things they did. The other thing they did was just important, though, and that was tell the people what God said. It didn't have to be anything about the future. It just had to be what God said. None of their words, just verbatim. This is what God told me. This is what I'm telling you. So sometimes you could get the prophet's message simply from going back to Deuteronomy and doing the deduction we did before. God promised judgment if they didn't obey. Nobody's obeying. In fact, to extreme levels, judgment's coming. That doesn't have to be a prophet to say judgment is coming. It just has to be, they're just telling the truth from God. But then there are several times, many times, countless times, where prophets tell things that no ordinary man or woman could ever tell. Because they're out into the future. They're in another time. They're not guessing because they have to be 100% right. So there is the foretelling, just telling what's been told, and there's the foretelling, telling something that's happened ahead of time. And those are both very true duties of a prophet. And I wouldn't even say that one's more important than the other. They both go in tandem. Now, their message, really they had a fourfold message. If you just break it down, their message basically normally was this. You're breaking the law. Turn back to God. If you don't turn back, judgment will come. And then there's always this beautiful thing of restoration. God's going to send a Messiah. You'll find that countless times through the prophets where even as they're prophesying the doom of Jerusalem, next thing you know, they're prophesying restoration and a Messiah. The main themes. See, when a prophet says something, oftentimes it was just for their own day. Many times it was a prophecy of their own captivity and return. Many times it was a prophecy of the first coming of Christ. Many times it was a prophecy of the messianic kingdom, the second coming of Christ. Many times it's a conglomeration of all of them. The prophet didn't necessarily know. God's giving a message. They're the conduit. They don't have to understand and explain all of it. They just have to pass it on. But you'll see many times these ideas blending. On this side of the cross, we understand many of those prophecies better than anybody in Israel at that time, some of the wisest people, because we know that Jesus fulfilled so many of them. And it helps us, and we know that history fulfilled many of them too. And so it helps us understand what's going to happen in the future, and it helps us understand that they will happen because we've already seen so many of them already happen. Concerning the minor, or concerning all the prophets, there's 17 prophetic books. Going through this real quick, you can look it up online if you want to see it. 12 were before the exile, 2 were during, 3 were after the exile. They wrote anywhere from the 9th to the 5th centuries BC. Different personalities, backgrounds, educations. The only thing in common they had was God put the call of prophet upon them. I'll just show you real quick the dated books. The dated minor prophet books, you can see them right there, are Hosea, Amos, Micah, Zephaniah, Haggai, and Zechariah. The undated ones are Joel, Obadiah, Jonah, Nahum, Habakkuk, or Habakkuk. We're not going to spend a night on pronunciation of that. And Malachi. And then just real quick so you can see what we're going to do. The canonical order, the order in the Bible is on the left. How we're going to do it is on the right. This is up on the website too. I don't know if it helps if you're going to either read through these books ahead of time. They're not that long. Or even go on to you might have the Bible on MP3 or just go on to like ESV.org, I think it is. Or a lot of these, they have the Bible in audio, you just press the button to listen, and you can just have it there, and it doesn't take that long to go through these books ahead of time. I'd encourage you to read up. But that's the order we're going to go in. We have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. I think we have 9 times altogether. This is one of them, so it's not on there. And then the rest will kind of go like that. This is what our map's going to look like at that time, because a lot's going to have to do with the captivity. And this is essentially how they went. They were taken out of Jerusalem by Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, taken to Babylon during the exile period. So that's what your map is going to look like. Okay. Didn't cover everything I wanted to, but we covered a lot. Enough, some might even say. Here's what I want to do. I want to spend a little bit of time in worship. We'll close in a few songs and just soak in the Lord. I encourage you to take this with you. Check out what's on the website. You know, just for now, if you're going to read ahead, Joel and Jonah. Joel especially is a pretty short book. That will be next week when we're together. Besides that, I know there's... I hate to do any overview that quick, because we missed a lot of things about just things like covenant in the Bible and just things that are so important. But we'll talk about that as we get further on, because we'll have more time. But let's worship.